house of mine going, man, I'm going to love my wife in a way that's going to blow everybody's mind. And Jesus is going to go, woo, you're awesome. And you give it about 7 seconds into the house. And I realize I'm already on a downhill journey past that, because the flesh, as Paul calls it, that starts screaming at me and going, oh, did you see that? How dare they treat you that? You know, you just start there. You're like, oh, and then suddenly the pressure and the things and you're out of it. And then the battle coming back to that and going, wait a second, what am I called to? I battle with that constantly in every area of my life. Paul says it literally. He writes and says in the scriptures, you have flesh and you have spirit, and they will battle against each other, because if you know Christ, there is a part of you that is conforming to become like him and to live in the world in which he functions. And there's another part of you that screams to want to stay in the world in which you live and in the world in which you function. And, you know, I wake up in the morning and I look at the world. I look at the world outside of my house and the borders of my neighborhood and the borders of my local community, outside of the borders of my country. And you look at the global arena and you realize, wow, there is a world out there that desperately needs me to spend myself for the sake of that world, because that's what I'm called to. And in exactly the same time that I'm thinking those things in the morning, there's another world screaming at me going, you know, you could really use an extra this. And did you hear that the new such and such just came out? And, you know, for only a few this, you can do that. And boy, you got a lot of needs. And I go, yes, I do. And there I am in the middle of my battle, in the middle of the two worlds colliding, God's call on my life and God's paradigms and God's world and my world and my life and my kingdom and the things I need and I do. And you know, on the stage here, it sounds pretty dramatic, but the reality is it's not always as easy to touch as I'm making it on the stage. Most of the time, we don't even realize this is going on in our lives, and we're just traveling through. And so often we're living right here in the world, which is I. And we forget about that. The story we're getting into today, probably more than any book in the Bible, in my opinion, if it can in a tangible way demonstrate the collision of two worlds, our world and God's world, it is the book in which we currently are traveling through, the book of Daniel. Because in the book of Daniel, we are given a picture of what our world looks like. We're given Babylon, we're given Nebuchadnezzar, we're given the other kings, and we're shown in clear, tangible form what an incredible world that is. I mean, Babylon, as you've heard as we've traveled through, was an enticing and beautiful and extraordinary and wonderful and magical place. It was everything you and I could possibly come up with. It was beauty beyond your wildest imagination. It was the pinnacle of what mankind can do with the creative juices that God has plugged into us. And boy, it was extraordinary. And in that world and in that city, if you're talking about a city that could teach you and show you what it meant to live a life on this planet that was prosperous and successful, this was the place. And into that city, God brings his people. And he walks in with them. I mean, he was there already, but you know, he walks in with them. And suddenly, throughout the book of Daniel, we see this massive collision between two worlds. On the one hand, God tangibly gives us Nebuchadnezzar and then the following kings after him and shows us their world. And then on the other hand, he makes it tangible through particularly one character and adding in three other characters, Daniel and his three friends. And as you remember, in this world, already as we've been traveling through Daniel, there have been some significant collisions, right? The kinds of collisions where God's world steps in. It started in chapter 1 when the boys were standing and saying, the God we serve tells us that we shouldn't indulge ourselves in all sorts of crazy things. Do you mind if we just eat vegetables? And they could have gotten into some trouble for that, but that world steps into the world of prosperity and it goes, whoa, what is that? And because they asked nicely, they got their deal and God shows himself true. First small collision. That collision dramatically increases next when a dream is brought to Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2. Nobody can interpret it. And Daniel walks in and God intersects Nebuchadnezzar's life and says, I can. In fact, I gave you the dream. And then in the third chapter, the biggest collision thus far that we found, that beautiful place where the same boys that were like, can we eat veggies, are standing in front of a massive ball of fire and they won't bow down and they go in and walk into fire and walk back out. Massive collision occurs there between the world of Nebuchadnezzar and our world and the world of God and his people. And you remember, they walk into the fire, they walk out of the fire, and woo, the two worlds collide in a big way. We walk into chapter 4, which is the last chapter that tells us the story about Nebuchadnezzar before he's going to die and the next king comes onto the scene in chapter 5. Grab your Bibles and turn to Daniel chapter 4 with me. If you don't have a Bible under the seats, there's a bunch of them. Grab one of ours. Just so you know, if you don't have a good Bible at home, take one of ours, put your name in it, take it home and keep it for yourself. We'd love for you to have a good Bible. Okay, so page 618 of our Bibles, Daniel chapter 4. If it's not one of our Bibles, Daniel chapter 4 in your Bible. We're going to start in the very beginning. Now, Daniel chapter 4 is an interesting chapter because it is Daniel writing down a speech or a declaration that King Nebuchadnezzar sent out to the people, and he records it here as God leads him to. And this is how that speech starts. You ready? King Nebuchadnezzar, to the peoples, nations, and men of every language who live in all the world. Who is this written to? Everybody. That's right. There's nobody that this isn't written to. May you prosper greatly. I feel like Spock. May you prosper greatly. All you Trekkies out there, you feel me right now. I know you do. All right. So it starts here. It is my pleasure to tell you about the miraculous signs and wonders that the Most High God has performed for me. How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an eternal kingdom. His dominion endures from generation to generation. And then he writes here, I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at home in my palace, contented and prosperous. I had a dream and it made me afraid. I love it. There it is. That's how we start. Nebuchadnezzar starts the speech by saying, it is my pleasure to tell you a story. Think of this chapter as the story you just watched in Jill's life, but except now Nebuchadnezzar's story. It's up on video, and he starts out in the video and he says, I am so excited to tell you my story. Now, it starts back in the palace when I was sitting in my room, and I was prosperous, and I was happy, and I was content. I had everything I could ever want. And then I had a dream, and it scared me really bad. That's basically what he says. And then he goes to his people like he did the last time, and he says, somebody tell me what this horrible dream means. And guess what? Surprise, surprise, nobody knows. So he remembers that when it came to dreams, there was somebody he could call on. And he calls on Daniel, who was also called Belshazzar at the time. That was his given name in Babylon. In verse 9, he says, I said, Belshazzar, chief of the magicians, I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in you, and no mystery is too difficult for you. And so he shares with him his incredible dream. A dream about a tree that gets cut down and loses all of its vibrance. And then the stump is left, but the tree is gone. And as he shares this story, and he tells Daniel in verse 19, this is what Daniel says in response. Then Daniel, also called Belshazzar, was greatly perplexed for a time, and his thoughts terrified him. Why is that? Well, listen, the last time Daniel stood before the king, it was a neat dream. And when Daniel got the dream, he could tell the king some really neat news. This time he hears the dream and God goes, tell him what I'm telling him. And Daniel's like, God, it's really bad. Yeah, tell him. He needs to hear it. No, you don't understand. He's the king. He might kill me. I know. Tell him. It's really bad. But I gave him the dream. Don't worry about it. Can you imagine if you're Daniel, you're standing before the king, and the king goes, tell me the dream. And God tells you, it's really bad. You should tell him. Wouldn't that terrify you? Understand how many times Daniel finds himself in a position, along with his three friends, where the call of God calls him to such impossibilities that he literally has to set his life aside for the sake of the call of God. You understand what I'm saying? And this was another one of those moments where Daniel's like, oh my gosh, I'm so gonna die for this. And guess what Daniel does? God throws him a little lifeline, and this is what it is. So the king said, Belshazzar, do not let the dream or its meaning alarm you. Yeah, every king says that. Don't worry, if it's bad news, I'll be fine. Sure, whatever. Belshazzar answered, my lord, if only the dream applied to your enemies and its meaning to your adversaries. I love that. What a great way to start bad news. I just want you to know what I'm about to tell you is horrible. But I really, if it were up to me and I could wish something, I'd wish this was for your enemies. Just so you know, I like you. You're an okay man, but here we go. Let's talk. And he lays out for Nebuchadnezzar the interpretation of the dream. And you can read it there, but here's basically what it boils down to. God says to Nebuchadnezzar, look, we have had some significant collisions, you and I. And every time we seem to have a collision, you jump up and you're the first to shout, "Oh, God is so powerful. He's so good." I mean, think about it. The first time when Daniel does the whole dream thing in chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar's like, "Your God is amazing. Your God can do all mysteries. Your God's the biggest of them all. Anybody speaks against his God, they're in trouble." That was his response. Massive interaction with God, understanding of God's power. Then you think that was big when he walks into the fiery furnace. You remember this one? "If anybody says a word about God that's bad, I will burn your house down and kill your family and do everything horrible to you." I mean, at that point, he's like, man, if there are some gods out there, this guy is the God of gods. I mean, massive interactions and massive realization. And then here in this chapter, what does he say as he's telling his story? He goes, "Yeah, I told Daniel, you know, all the gods reside in you because your God's so big that he has all the other gods and all their wisdom in you too." He still didn't get it. You see that? Acknowledges God, understands his power, but misses the entire point. So God comes here and he says to Daniel, "Tell Nebuchadnezzar, if he doesn't figure this thing out and he does not step into the world where he doesn't just acknowledge that I am the biggest of the gods, but that he understands that I am the creator and sustainer and follows me, things are going to get really, really bad for him. And then he's going to face some horrible circumstances, not as a punishment, but as the natural consequences to a man that lives his life acknowledging God on the one hand, but not following him." And Daniel ends the discussion in verse 27 with this: "Therefore, O king, be pleased to accept my advice." Really sorry about the bad news. "Renounce your sins by doing what is right, and your wickedness by being kind to the oppressed. It may be that then your prosperity will continue." Isn't that amazing? Here's a dream, and God goes, "It's going to get really bad if you continue down this path. But if you step into my world, you will save the journey you're about to go on." In verse 28, it simply says this: "All this happened to King Nebuchadnezzar. 12 months later," this is after the dream, "as the king was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, he said, 'Is not this great Babylon I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty?'" That sounds really bad. And you know how bad it sounds? Let me show you next verse. "The words were still on his lips when a voice came from heaven." Oh my gosh, you know this is a bad moment. If you, by the way, if you're ever talking and you're saying something you know you really, really shouldn't, and a voice comes down from heaven, just take my word for it. That's a bad moment, okay? That's usually God going, "Okay, enough, we've had it." And here Nebuchadnezzar, I can imagine the poor man like, "Yeah, this is all for my glory, Nebuchadnezzar. Oh, those! I didn't mean it. I swear, this is all for you. You're the man." Too late. And you know what happens to Nebuchadnezzar? It's an extraordinary thing. This great king, instantaneously, God changes his mind, and he literally goes crazy, insane. So badly, just as the dream had said, that he, for 7 years, he lives eating grass. His nails grow so long that they're like claws of animals. His hair grows so long that he looks like an animal, and he lives as an animal. And in 7 years of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, think of all that could have happened during that time. He is living as a wild animal. No doctor on the planet can do anything about it, and God locks him into that world. Have you ever been in a place in your life where you've got your young kids, you know, and they do something that they really shouldn't do? And as they do it, the consequence of what they're doing at that time is minuscule. You know, they take something they shouldn't take, or they run into a place they shouldn't run into. They hide from you in a way that they shouldn't hide from you. And the consequences on this one are tiny. But as you play it out over 20 years and you go, if they make these decisions later on in life, the consequences are going to be massive. So what you do is, as a parent, you bring big consequences now, despite the little consequence that they resulted, so that they can learn quickly that you may have gotten away with this now, but in time, it is the getting away with this that kills you, not the thing itself, because the things you'll do will just get bigger. And in so many ways, this story of Nebuchadnezzar is such a tangible and beautiful picture that God hands us as his people and hands the world to say, listen now, There are two worlds that function, my world and your world. And those two worlds will collide. And as you travel through your world, every time I collide with your life and I call you in, if you acknowledge me, but you don't follow me, here's the deal. It may not seem as tangible as old Nebi here, but I can tell you this. Slowly but surely, you will walk your way into madness. Because at the end of the day, when you do things my way, it leads to life and freedom. And when you do it your way, it leads to death and destruction. And the horrible part about the battle we face is it is often not as tangible as Jill's story, or often not as tangible as Nebuchadnezzar's story. It is subtle and it is hidden. And we think we're getting away with stuff because we're acknowledging but not stepping in. And in the end, what ends up happening is that we lose. And this story shouts out to us saying, Nebuchadnezzar had every reason in the interactions he had with the mighty God to be able to say, not only is this a big God, he is the God and I'm going to follow him. And instead, he chose continuously to acknowledge God and then say, but I built this and I did this and it's about me. And we look at Nebuchadnezzar and we're like, wow, what a crazy guy. But as I shared with you when we started this, every day I find myself there. Every day I'm doing what Nebuchadnezzar does. I'm battling in my mind between this day being about me or this day being about God, about my story or his story, about the things that I have and the things that I do being about me or about him. And every day I'm first to acknowledge God, but am I first to follow him? Huge difference. At the end of this chapter, Nebuchadnezzar writes, and he says in verse 37, now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of heaven because everything he does is right and all his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. I love that. That's after he wakes up from 7 years of madness. Can you imagine that one? As he's shaving his hair and he's cutting his long nails and he's getting dressed into a normal set of clothes again. He's looking in the mirror and he's like, I definitely don't want to do that again. That was not fun. And grass and steak, man, I'm going with a steak deal. Excuse me, vegetarians. So at the end of the day, as we step into this world, looking at Nebuchadnezzar, we ask ourselves, God, where is it in my life that I am acknowledging you, but that I am not tangibly following you? I'm not acting out on what I know is true. I'm just talking or thinking about it. What does this mean for you and I? What does this mean for us? You know what's fascinating about the Bible? God very clearly in Scripture calls me to something very specific, and he calls you to something very specific. Why can I say that? Because not only do I know that God has plans for your life and mine, but we, if we follow Christ, are part of the church, and God has a very specific call on the life of the church. He created the church for something very specific. It starts out in Matthew and in several other places in the Gospels, but specifically in Matthew, where God says, I want you to go into all of the world, and I want you to make disciples of everyone, meaning that I want you to teach them what it means to obey my commands so that they can walk into the same freedom you have, and I want you to baptize them, that is, to invite them, to bring them in to the body of Christ, to the church. I want you to baptize them in and teach them how to follow me, because in following me, they will not live Nebuchadnezzar's life, but they will live Daniel's life. Go and do that. Go, all the world, all the nations, everybody. And then as though to take it a step further, he steps into the second call and he shows us in tangible form what the church looked like early on. When he first started the church in the book of Acts, we see this incredible, beautiful picture of the church emerge. And in the book of Acts, it says to us in chapter 2, the church was this place where everybody that had anything gave it up so that those who didn't have and had need were fulfilled and so that we could take care of them. And then when they had enough, they gave up everything they had to give it back to somebody else. It's like those beautiful pictures that you sometimes see when you're watching stories about the Holocaust or stories about times when in human history that were terrible. And when a little kid has a half a piece of bread and there's three other kids and that's all he's had for days. And then he tears it into three pieces and he hands it down the line. And we all go, oh, oh, and we cry and we weep and it's unbelievable. And how could somebody do that? And then God gets up in front of us and says, that's what I've called you to. You can and should live that life, taking the bits that you have and going, anybody else need some? if the church functions like that, then what happens when we find all the nations and we show them this is what God's world looks like when you live it out? Can you imagine? Well, they did in the book of Acts. Thousands a day came running to the gates going, can we come in? Never seen anything like this. And then as though to take it one final step, God steps out here in the book of James and he says, hey, listen, church, you want to know what kind of religion I love? You want to talk religion? Let's talk religion for a second. The kind of religion that takes care of the widows and the orphans and the poor, is the father to the fatherless, is the rescue to those in slavery. It is taking care of the destitute. It is taking care of those who can't take care of themselves. You want to talk about the redemptive process of the gospel? Here it is. You want to see the gospel work? When the gospel works, it should be a passionate, it is my pleasure to tell you about the miraculous story of Jesus to the nations. It should be a passionate, I got some bread, you need some? In the church. And it should be a passionate declaration of action into the communities of the world saying, we're not just here to tell you about Jesus, we're here to show you Jesus. And he is redemption. So where do you need some redemption? You need some fresh water? Great, done. You need some medical needs? Done. Boom. You need some help with orphan care? Bam, done. And when that works together, it's extraordinary. So there's our call, right? There's Mosaic's call. There's the church's call as a whole. And guess what? As we've been sharing with you guys, instead of sitting around here and going, that's awesome, we should do that, we just got up in the morning and said, forget this, we're doing it. And so as we were growing as a church plant and we were working on getting things done here, we just started going, you know what? I mean, part of the reason why you're squished into this little building right here and you're going, oh, there's no seats, is because a year and a half ago when we said we should probably build something bigger, we looked at that and we went, wait, we're not even taking care of the world yet. How can we do that? We got a little bit of bread. We're sharing this bread. That doesn't mean we'll never build, and it doesn't mean we don't need some more space, which we will get into, and we're looking into. But the point is, there is a priority list here that we got to stick with. And so we jump in as a church, and we say, we share the bread we've got before we start asking for more bread. And we start jumping in Ethiopia. We went in January. When we landed in Ethiopia, we hit the ground and we got an opportunity like nobody's business. They said, come, we got 1,000 orphans in Oxum. We've got 1,000 beggars here that are old or disabled. We don't know what to do with them. Can you help? We have no fresh water. Can you help? We have no consistency in electricity. Can you help? Can you do something? So we sat down with them and we said, we think we can. We started right out the gates arriving here and saying, we got children we need you to sponsor. And we laid 40 children in front of you and said, we need your help. Guess what? Those children, not only are they being taken care of, we try to get a hold of Samir who heads that up, and we haven't been able to get a hold of him because sometimes in Oxum, internet goes down in the entire city for 1 month. Isn't that awesome? Can you imagine? I mean, when your internet goes down in your house and you're like pulling out your hair and you're going nuts and you're rushing over to the neighbor's house. In Oxum, you can rush over to the neighbor's house and they go, you can come back next month. And so we've had some trouble getting a hold of them sometimes, and it goes back and forth, and I'm sure they're down right now because I haven't heard back from Samir. And here's the cool part. As I've been talking with Samir over the last few months and with David in town there, the children every week are getting the things that they need. Do you know what we did? We decided, because we sent some money into a bank account over there, and it took us like a month and a half to get the money to transfer because of the banking system there. And so they got behind a couple of weeks, and they couldn't take care of the kids. So we said, forget that. That'll never happen again. So we sent a full year's worth of money for the children, the 10 children in the one orphanage. And we sent 4 months worth of money to the other orphanage. And we said to them, every 2 months, we'll send the next 2 months so that there's always a 2 month problem gap. If it takes that long to get the money to you, you're still fine. So we just stepped up and we said, we're doing that. So your money that you are pouring into this place to be able to save and help orphans is actually doing its thing as we speak. Not only that, but we got paperwork into Ethiopia, and we said, listen, if we want to establish a permanent team on the ground that will care in a huge way for this city, we need to be able to be an organization that is officially approved in Ethiopia. Very hard to get. We just got the paperwork back a few weeks ago saying you're official, which now means we can get into Ethiopia anywhere we want, anytime we want, to do anything we want there to serve and help that nation. And when we bring in our equipment, our trucks, our buildings, whatever else, no taxes, because we've got this special permission that we're here to serve, so we're doing that. wells. We want to dig wells and need fresh water. So we did all this research over the last 4 months. Guess what we found? We found a company that puts a well in the ground. They tie it to a merry-go-round in a little kid's park. They tie that to a bathroom with three bathrooms in it. And what happens is as the kids go around the merry-go-round, it pumps water out of the well into a holding tank, which then goes down into the sanitation, becomes flushing toilets, and filters the other way through for fresh drinking water. Then the water filters out of that into a big thing they put in the ground that sifts the water through as it sifts through the ground, and by the time it gets back down underground to where it's being pumped out of, it's perfectly fresh water again, right? And to put these wells in is a couple of $1,000. And we were like, for like $8,000, we can put a well in like that where there's a playground and bathrooms in a city where there's no playgrounds, bathrooms, or water. And we're like, sweet! This is incredible! We're doing it! So we've started working on getting the first ones in October. And here we go in Oxum, Ethiopia, right? In Jamaica, we're stepping into Jamaica, and there's a team on the ground in Jamaica right now as we sit here training pastors this weekend to become more effective in their churches because they have no resources or training. And so we're helping them to become more effective in their local communities to make change. And we were in Jamaica and Brazil, and we're talking with them about how we can serve, and they go, man, we got all these children, and it's really difficult, and we got to help them. So we go, what if we did children's ministry in all these countries? And then we suddenly realized, wait a second, if we're going to do children's ministry in all these countries, we need to bring curriculum that actually means something to them. Can you imagine doing a VBS with Gator Dockside in Brazil or in Ethiopia? Oh, let's deal with issues that have nothing to do with you and you don't even know what a gator is. That doesn't make any sense. So guess what we have to do now? We have to write curriculums for VBSs for each individual country in which we're in. So we've already started doing that. We're already preparing to get that done. And as we're doing that, it suddenly dawned on us. You ready for this? We work with several organizations, right? One of which is Vision 360. That's kind of been part of what we've been doing here. And Vision 360 has a vision to take 500 cities around the globe and to put a city visionary in each of those 500 cities who has a strategic plan to recruit and bring in new church plants, to plant churches in that city in such a way that it meets the needs of that city holistically and becomes a transforming force in the city. Pretty cool, right? So we're talking about that, and we're working on that strategy, and we're thinking about that. And then Mosaic Global Mission, we've realized the children of the world need our help, and the orphans in particular. So I suddenly start thinking, what if we establish an orphan care program, if you will, in every one of these cities that brings little children in, we care for them holistically, we train them, we educate them, we teach them about the love of Jesus. By the time they're 16, 17, 18, they're raising their hands and saying, I want to serve Jesus, how do I do it? And we say, you plant churches, we've already trained you to do it. And then I show up at those 500 international cities and I go, I've got a couple of thousand church planters from your country ready to plant churches, what do you think we should do? 15 years from now, that can be a real reality for us. 20 years from now, we could actually see those churches launching in all these cities. And I look at that and I go, what? Are you kidding me? And then I started realizing, you know what? What are we called to? Go into all the world, yes, okay. Take care of your local body together, right? And take care of the orphans, widows, and poor around you. So I go, you know what? We might be global, but what about right here? What about this church? What about Oakland right next to us? What about Claremont? What about Winter Garden? So I sit down with some people and I start talking to Jackie Farley. And you know, when you hand Jackie Farley something, just expect it to explode into something way beyond you could have ever imagined. So I talk to Jackie and I'm like, can you work on a plan for local missions where our church can get their hands dirty right here in the community? And she goes, okay. And I had no idea. I mean, this week I said to her, can you email me the plan so I can tell everybody in the church? And I'm expecting, I said, make it detailed because I need details that I can tell people. And I'm thinking about my version of detailed, which would be instead of a code word, it would actually be a sentence, you know? And I open the email up from Jackie, and it's pages of information with priority one, priority two, priority three, priority four, the plan for each priority, which organization she's already contacted, how we're going to help those organizations in our local community, how Oakland's going to change forever, how all the buildings are. And I'm reading and I'm like, I couldn't read this to everybody if I tried. And so I'm going through this thing and I'm like, okay, I gotta pick a few things out of here, but I don't even know what to pick. There's too many to pick from. I mean, she has in here as the first priority that we need to become the church we need to. So we need to establish things within the church where we know how to barter with one another and how to switch things we can do for each other and how we can share what we have, the bread we hold, each of you hold, how you can share it so that we all have our needs met. She has plans up the wazoo for that. And they're actually practical. They actually work. They're not like dreaming plans like mine always are. We could do that. This is actually like, I've thought it through and it actually works. And I'm like, wow, that's amazing. Priority two, Oakland, Florida, because that's the community in which we exist. And Oakland needs our help. And Jackie's put together a plan with already what's been going on. People like Paul and Pete and those guys who have been working in Oakland and already laying the groundwork and already jumping in. And they were kind of floundering out there doing their thing. And we were jumping on board. And Jackie starts going, we got to jump in and help these guys to do what they do. They got a passion for Oakland. We got to make it happen. And so putting a plan together to reshape Oakland. And it's actually real again. And then priority three is beyond Oakland, the local community around us, and eventually Orlando. And then eventually the entire state of Florida, and then we're into global missions, which is back where we started. And I sit and I look at all of this, and I go, man, have we got a story that we're part of. We are going to live out the call that we have to hit all three of those arenas as a church. And you know what it dawned on me then as I'm thinking about that? I realize if that's the life we're going to live here at Mosaic, can I just give you a little warning? Two worlds will be colliding here day after day. Absolutely, because I'll tell you why. There is only one way we will ever accomplish that. And that is if we as a church understand now that spending ourselves for the sake of the gospel matters. And that it's not just talk, it's real. And it's got to translate. We have this little thing here called live simply, work diligently, give generously, right? And today is what? Live Simply Sunday. And we made Live Simply Sundays as a reminder to all of you that there are kids out there that you said you'd sponsor, and you need to remember to do that. Otherwise, when we send months and months of money in advance, at some point we're going to shut down all the lights here for that. And let me tell you, we'll do it if we have to, because those kids are going to get what they need. But as we do that, as we did Live Simply Sunday, I realized this picture is much bigger than the orphans that we are currently sponsoring. It's an entire story that we can be part of changing the entire world. For real, for real. I mean, do you understand what I'm telling you? That 30 years from now, we could all sit here together, old and gray, and go, I think we've changed the world. I mean, I think the entire world is different because God used us to do that. But the only way that's going to happen is if we don't live in Nebuchadnezzar's world, but that we live in Daniel's world, where every now and then you get to that edge and you go, this is all I have, man. And God goes, I know you're about to die, but I'll carry you through. This is a fiery furnace, dude. I know, but it's going to be okay. Versus Nebuchadnezzar who goes, oh, you a big God. You really awesome. Anyways, look at the city I built. Isn't that pretty cool? Yeah. And you know what? Unfortunately, most of the time, our neat sayings in churches like live simply, work diligently, give generously. You know what they turn into? Bumper stickers and t-shirts. And in this church, I just want to tell you, if our sayings turn into bumper stickers and t-shirts, things we talk about and we're like all excited about, we're like, oh, are you living simply? Yeah, I'm living simply. Wonderful. If that's what it translates into, then this story never happens. But if that translates into real time and real money that can be spent to save the world, then it becomes real. And are you ready for this? If it's going to translate into real time and real money, then that means you and I are going to face a battle, aren't we? A collision of two worlds. The world that says, oh, hold, and the world that says, oh, die. And if each of us step up and say, I'm going to live in Daniel's world with my time and my resources, then we will change the world. Let me just translate this into practical for you. And this is the dreamer in me, so bear with me for a few seconds here. I'm so sorry. I sat this week and I said, okay, we have, on any given Sunday, actually showing up in the building around 600 adults that walk in here. Not that doesn't include all the crazy little under 10-year-olds out there that are killing our children's ministry workers. Love you, kids. Those 600 people show up here. I sat back and I said, you know what? What would happen, and this is a minuscule deal, but what would happen if this story of live simply, work diligently, give generously translated into $20 for each person? That's three cups of Starbucks coffee, give or take, with tax. Okay? What if that translated every week into $20 for each person to say, I'm going to make a way to make this happen, even if it stretches me? You know what that translates into? You ready for this? It translates into $480,000 a year. If you ask me, Renaud, what would you do with $480,000 this year that you don't currently have? If you were willing to ask for that from the people, what would you do? Do you know how many wells come to mind? a lot. If you're talking about $8,000 a well, you start figuring that calculation out. Oh, you know how many orphans come to mind? You know how many stories come to mind? You know how many teams we can plant on the ground right now with that kind of money? Are you ready for this? Step back for a second. You ready for this? If every one of us, now I'm stepping into Daniel's world, so just brace yourself. Don't get all scared and freaked out and go, oh, we can never. Just walk with me into Daniel's world for a second. What if each one of us figured out this next year how to come up with $100 a week? That means selling a car and getting an older one and not having the car payment, those kinds of level of things, you know, those big, big things. And we said $100 a week that we'll lay down for living simply, giving generously. You know what that translates into with 600 of us? Are you ready? Breathe deeply now. $3.2 million a year. $3.2 million a year out of this little church that would dig wells, save orphans, change the world, put teams on the ground. That's three times our budget, our entire annual budget. You know what we could do with that? Are you ready for this one? God calls us as believers to tithe, and tithe turns into 10% of what God gives you up front. I'm willing to bet that for most of us, it would translate into the $3,000 to $5,000 a year. It sounds like a pretty small number, doesn't it, when you think of it as an annual number, which is $100 a week at $5,000 a year. Isn't that crazy? Do you see why I'm on this stage talking like this? Because you know, if you're part of Mosaic, I never ask for money. And people always tell me, why do you never ask for money and never pass a plate and never do all that? And I'm like, because I don't want people to feel like crazy people in a church where, oh, the church is going to get their money. And then someone said to me this week, what would you do with $3 million to change the world? And I said, I would change everything, the entire planet. And they're like, you know, all you have to do is ask. Just say, guys, there's two boxes in the back. $3 million will change the world forever. Just ask. And I was like, you're right. Listen to this. I close with this thought. Very last book of the Old Testament, Malachi. Last prophet that wrote in the Old Testament, not only physically in the book, but chronologically. Last written piece into the Old Testament. And here's what it says in Malachi chapter 3 in verse 10. Bring the whole tithe into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house. Test me in this, says the Lord Almighty, and see if I will not throw open the floodgates of heaven and pour out so much blessing that you will have no room enough for it. I will prevent pests from devouring your crops, and vines from your fields will not cast their fruit, says the Lord Almighty. Then all the nations will call you blessed, for yours will be the delightful land, says the Lord Almighty. If we step out of acknowledging God and step into following God, if we make our sayings not bumper stickers and t-shirts, but that they translate into tangible time and money, then we get into a place where God's going, watch what I will do with your story. The nations won't know what to do with you. And the very first book of the New Testament in Matthew, this is what he says in Matthew. In Matthew chapter 16, verse 24, listen to this. Jesus is speaking as though to start the New Testament out. He says this in verse 24, then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will find it. I will leave you with this single thought. I'm not here to try to get your money. I promise you, if you know me, you know me better than that. I'm here because I can't sleep so well at night anymore knowing that there's millions of dollars that are laying out there that we could change the world with, and I'm trying to figure out how to find $8,000 to dig one well. That just blows my mind. I'm sitting with our missions department going, look, we're doing this. I'm not asking you to find the money. I'm telling you we're doing this, and if we die, then it's over. So either we find it or we... I mean, those are the kinds of discussions I'm having about the world out there. We're doing great here. But part of the reason that we're doing so great here is that I don't have to come beg for money all the time. And then you just kind of forget. And suddenly I realize, wait a second. God says to us in the Old and the New Testament, finish and start. You spend yourself for me, and you will be the Daniel standing in front of a lion's den or a fiery furnace or Nebuchadnezzar telling him a bad dream. And I will show you what I will do with your story. If you acknowledge me, but you don't follow me tangibly, then you will live fine and prosperous and successful as Nebuchadnezzar did. But in the end, you will walk into a place of madness. Let us not be that story, but let us spend ourselves for the sake of the gospel. I want to ask every one of you, not even as couples, although do it as couples too. I want you to ask God today, And this week, God, what do I need to do with my time and my resources to create more stuff to change a bigger world? Do that, and Live Simply Sundays will turn into miracles here as we see more and more wells dug and more orphans changed and more cities changed. And in 15, 20 years from now, the orphans of today will become the leaders of tomorrow because you spent yourself for them. Let's tear the bread. Let's work diligently. And as we do it, let's save the community that exists right outside of our walls as we give our time and energy away for it. Man, what a story.